food is the basic stuff of culture. Just think about your favorite flavor, and you're probably remembering something your great-grandmother would have cooked. So Alaska's unique foods are the key to whatever is unique in our culture. That ranges from Yupik fish heads to Samoan pig roasts to Asian fusion and expensive Anchorage restaurants. What food defines your culture, and what would you share if we could all sit down together? It's Alaskan Cuisine on this election day, Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Condor Airlines, with connecting flights from Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Kodiak, Nome, and Prudhoe Bay to Anchorage on Alaska Airlines, and continuing nonstop service to Frankfurt. Details at condor.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Charles Woolforth, sitting in for Steve Heimel on this Election Day 2012. Get out and vote. We're picking a president. We're picking a new legislature. And that's all you're going to hear about that from me today, because we're taking a break from politics to talk about food. And I'm really hoping that we're going to hear from listeners about your favorite dishes that are unique to your culture, where you come from in life, and what you think is our Alaskan cuisine. What is our culture in Alaska? Do we have one? Are we just a total mixing pot? I know we all individually have somewhere we come from in terms of food. And so that's going to be our topic today. And I've got two experts that I'm really excited about talking about this in the studio today. Rob Kanin is a local foods advocate. He has the fresh49.com blog, and he is producing his own bottled sauces and is really proselytizing local foods. Well, thanks for being with us, Rob.
Absolutely.
And Jack Amon is with the Marx Brothers Restaurant, kind of the first of the modern fine dining restaurants in Anchorage, and also has the Muse Restaurant at the Anchorage Museum. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Charles. Pleasure to be here.
So we were chatting, Jack, a little bit before the show began about is there an Alaskan cuisine? And I really think it does. You know, is there an Alaskan culture? I mean, we know there's some characteristics, sort of this sense of independence and so forth, that are Alaskan culture. But it's hard to put your finger exactly on a defining Alaskan cuisine, although there are some uniquely Alaskan dishes. How do you feel when you're thinking about chefs and food that's produced around Alaska? Is there anything identifiable about what we all do in terms of cooking?
I think that our roots are in the Pacific Northwest, because we kind of grew up from there. So you see a lot of treatments that are in the new American cuisine range. And we have such a diverse quality of ingredients. I mean, we always think about our seafood, but there's also local mushrooms, fiddlehead ferns, and things like that that really can define our cuisine in a way. Well, I think what I had said before was the defining thing about Alaskan cuisine is that there is no defining culinary theme in Alaskan cuisine. We see Pan-Asian influences. We see everything from French and Italian influences going into our foods. But the common theme is the use of our local ingredients.
And when you started the Marx Brothers in the late 1970s, started a little bit as a hobby, right? I mean, you love cooking and loved putting things together, and then you started sharing it with others.
Exactly so. I think we were the first kind of fusion place in Anchorage. We brought different ethnic cuisines into our cooking, and we also took an Alaskan approach in that we were the first of the casual fine dining kind of restaurants. While we were a white tablecloth and had crystal glasses, we dispensed with the formality that went along with that kind of cuisine. And I think that's a very Alaskan theme.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because nothing's more foreign than the idea of having a dress code in an Alaskan restaurant. That would never go over. But you also have a garden. Do you still serve some of your food from your own garden?
Oh,
you
absolutely.
Serve tons of local food, right?
Yes, we grow our own lettuces that we use, and also a great variety of herbs and edible flowers.
Rob, you are Tlingit by ethnicity, but grew up mostly in Anchorage, and you've been involved in food all your life. Do you have a feeling of what's Alaskan food? I mean, native foods obviously are totally Alaskan. There couldn't be anything more Alaskan. But there's a lot of cultures in Alaska, and I don't know if there's anything that connects it all.
I think we were mentioning that earlier. I think the connecting point is the opportunity at hand. And what I mean by that is, a few years ago, it just over and over, 95% of our food is imported from Alaska. Less than 5% is actually grown or produced in Alaska. And when I kind of started breaking it down in my head, what I kind of thought about was you've got the contemporary food supply, so you've got the farmers in the valley and the ranching, and fishing is probably more traditional, but it's translated into contemporary. And then you've got an indigenous food supply, and that's sort of off the radar in a lot of ways. And those are some of the things that I've been kind of advocating for and looking at, in the sense of also what it can take to take those traditional foods and sort of add, the third part of that is technology. So, I've got a couple of examples here, and then I've also got, some of the other ideas, just kind of adding, whether it be an IQF, processing plant, or ways that we can take the product from Alaska and value add it to keep it around for longer than, the 3 months in the summer or the 4 week window in the fall. So that's kind of what I've been looking at. And I think the opportunity is in the influence of people coming up here.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned native foods and traditional Alaska native cooking, which obviously is different in each region of the state. And I actually have eaten a lot of different homes all over the state, and really most of the traditional native foods I really like, even though they're really different from what you're familiar with. So, you were talking on at the museum recently about seal, and how that's got such a strong flavor, and that seal oil flavor is really distinctive, I think really interesting and tasty, but not something that I ever get to eat unless I'm a guest in a native home. And so it's, in a way, it doesn't really spread out into the broader culture.
Some of it, that's true. I mean, obviously, you're never going to go to a restaurant to get seal. I've served it in traditional banquets, places like at the Heritage Center, where there's a group coming in, and I'm being compensated for my time, but we're not charging at the door for a plate of food. But I think that's, the low-hanging fruit, if you will. I mean, berries, spruce tips, seaweed. There is a lot of opportunity, I think, with ingredients up here.
Things that we could do sort of in a more of a mass thing. I mean, we all pick our own berries, but you could actually be gathering seaweed sort of in a larger setting and selling it at a farmer's market or something like that.
Two things. One, you have to, and I've been doing some research on that, but anything from the sea has got to have a license.
Oh, okay.
So you can pick beech asparagus, but if you're buying on your land with the approval of the owner, and then if you're actually pulling anything from the sea, seaweed for example, you have to actually have a permit. But yes, in that respect, and that's kind of what I have, I talked about bringing some treats, and these are, I'm the chef liaison at the Sitka Seafood Festival. So when you go to the farmer's market in Sitka, you can walk through there, and there's a company called Simple Pleasures, and they have seaweed chutneys and other uniquely Alaskan ingredients. This is a friend of mine, Gimbal Botanicals, and she does dried seaweed veggies. So this is actually bladderwrack, something you see on rocks, something you scrape off your boat before you go out. And she actually takes it and dries it, and it's almost like a little popcorn.
Oh, wow. I want to try some of that. Why don't you put some of that on the plates and pass some to Jack and some to me, and I'm going to give out the phone numbers for callers. It's the topic today is food, and we would like to hear your thoughts on what is Alaskan food, and also if you've got any favorite dishes to share or thoughts about how local foods can be produced in the kitchen, and basically anything you want to say about food. What is your culture? What is your food tradition? So to do that, just give me a call at 800-478-8255. That's 800-478-TALK. That's outside of Anchorage. If you're within Anchorage, you can call 550-8422. And today is a particularly good day to use email. It's talk@alaskapublic.org. We'll read those on the air, and you know, maybe if we come up with some good recipes, we could share those over our website, which is alaskapublic.org. Just click on Talk of Alaska, and you'll find us. And there's already some activity going on Facebook, which you can read at the bottom of that page, and links to my two guests, Rob Kanin and Jack Ammon. So let's try this. So this is seaweed from Sitka.
It is.
So it looks like what we would call popweed.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I like it. Will you try it, Jack?
Yeah, it's like a seaweed potato chip.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah. I could see munching on that. So how do they make this?
You know, I think she gathers it and then just dries it. You know, and I think it's a... I'm not sure.
It's naturally salty. Well, how do you make sure when you're gathering food like that? I mean, you say, well, it's everywhere. But somebody could have just walked on it right before you picked it, right? So how do you make sure it's pure?
I think, you know, I know I'm kind of looking at a couple of... I'm negotiating a couple of deals with the bottles, with the sauces that I'm producing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it has to do with working with entities that have the resources to go out and pick and procure. And doing that, obviously, you're not down at the Coastal Trail, you know, doing this or out of Beluga Point. But, you know, in Southeast, for example, I mean, there's a lot of acreage that's pretty unadulterated that mm-hmm. people don't go to unless they're, you know, doing something specific.
Right. And so if I'm in my cabin in Kachemak Bay and there's popweed, I can just basically take it off the rocks, put it in the sun and dry it, and it'll taste like this?
You know, I remember as a child, my great-grandmother would have it's kind of a black seaweed, and they would take it and just sort of put it on a window screen. So you mm-hmm. have the air coming through out of the sun. Mm-hmm. That's how I remember her doing it. I don't know how this is done.
And it's a good idea to have some kind of a book so you don't pick something poisonous. So we had a somewhat funny incident along those lines. A couple of years ago, we were the knowledgeable guy. I won't say his name because it's a little bit embarrassing. And he's waving his arms saying, everything you see here is edible. And he picks up something off the ground and hands it to my, you know, 8-year-old daughter and says, try this. And she, you know, eats it bravely. And then he eats some himself. And then the next morning, we get a phone call. Are you guys sick? Is your daughter sick? He was up all night puking. Everything is edible. Not always true. Jack, are you able to use any wild foods in either of your restaurants? Or at least, I mean, if you use game, like I'm sure you use duck and stuff like that, it's coming from a farm or something, right?
That's right. You know, the only Alaskan game meat that's legal for us to serve is reindeer, which is like caribou. And that's what we were talking about earlier, is that there's the restaurant cuisine and the home cuisine. And there's so many treats, like getting Sitka deer is one of the great treats of living up here. And one of the most memorable meals I had was a friend who had just been hunting, and it was fall, winter like this, and we had Sitka deer chops with just a little Worcestershire sauce and salt and pepper. But when I was eating it, I was going, this has all the nutrition I need to live up here. This is really, it was inside of me. Not only was the taste good, but the nutrition that came from it was exceptional. Mm-hmm. So I think we as Alaskans have a chance to eat food that people from outside or in the restaurants don't get to see.
Yeah. Well, you brought up the topic of simplicity. And I recall a few years ago being in a fine dining restaurant. It wasn't yours, but I asked the waiter, well, this is delicious. I think it was an artichoke or something. How did you prepare this? And I love artichokes. And then he proceeds to stand there for 5 minutes, giving me the 30 steps for making this until I was ready to tell him after about a minute, okay, forget it. This is never going to happen. But there is a benefit, especially with the ingredients we have in Alaska. Simplicity sometimes is really the right way to go, right?
I find that's true in the themes of all of our food. If you start with really great ingredients, your biggest challenge is not to mess them up.
Which means don't dump, if you've got some great halibut, don't dump a bunch of cheese on it or something like that, right?
Right, and cook it properly. Don't overcook it so its own natural deliciousness comes through. You know, you want your halibut nice and moist and your salmon kind of on the medium rare side. And, You know, I think those are important parts in how we handle our food.
Yeah, and anybody can do that. You don't have to be a master chef. You just have to pay attention when you're cooking to where you've gotten to with that fish. And if it's salmon, you know, it needs to be still a little bit, have a little bit of that that translucent quality in the middle, not be all totally turned to the other, you know, how it changes. I can't think of what the right word for that would be, right?
Yeah, and all the fats cook out of it, so then the fish can feel dry.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go to Lisa, who's calling from Sitka. Lisa?
Hi, this is Lisa, and you were all asking about some uniquely Alaskan foods. I live here in Sitka, and we have these amazing Sitka roses, and then towards the fall, we get these lovely rose hips that are just plump and wonderful. And I have done a lot of experimenting over the last several years with rose hips and turn them into a puree, kind of following the recipes at Cooperative Extension in their Alaska Wild Berries publication, and have had really good luck with making absolutely splendid fruit leather that just has a little bit of honey and lemon juice in it, as well as kind of using the puree for rose hip bread, which is an absolutely delicious and beautiful color. And rose hip cookies. So I'm just curious if you all have had much experience working with rose hip.
Rob, have you worked with rose hip?
I've used it in prepared, like jellies and things like that, and I have used it in syrups. It's the window on them is so quick. So yeah, I haven't gone out and picked them. I am familiar with the product, definitely.
Yeah. So what is the distinctive flavor of a rose hip? Is it tangy or?
You know, I think of it as a little tart. I like it. I mean, I think the mass, you know, I just did a dinner down in Denver, Colorado, and I did a pan-seared salmon with a rose hip vinaigrette. Mm. I didn't use Alaskan rose hips because I didn't have the quantity to use for 300 people. But it was just, you know, I balanced it out with some honey and oregano and just kind of used that, and it was fantastic. So it's traditionally there's agua de Jamaica, which is a rose hip, or basically a rose hip water. They use that in agua frescas in Mexico and the Caribbean. So it's kind of that's a commercial venue to find it.
Thanks, Lisa. That's a good one. That's kind of a regional one because in Anchorage we don't have many rose hips, but I know you have a ton of them down there.
Yes, we have lots of them there, and a lot of them are still hanging on the vine, so to speak.
And still good. They're probably getting aged at this point, huh?
Yeah, but, you know, so long as you've got the pulp and you basically just cook the whole thing down, you know, I tried the whole thing. They're very seedy, of course, so there's not a whole lot of pulp. But so just pretty much taking them all together, boiling them with some water, and then I use kind of a jelly press to kind of push out the puree, and then you freeze the puree. Now, if you're going to use, you know, try to get the juice from it, you could actually can it, jar it up. But with the puree, it can pretty much only be frozen.
Okay.
Yeah, well, it's really a wonderful, wonderful food to work with, and it's and the color is just unlike anything I've really seen. So
great, thanks for that tip. And I want to thanks for calling. I want to let other listeners know that we would love to hear your shared ideas for uniquely Alaskan foods, or even foods that, if not uniquely Alaskan, are especially Alaskan. If our phone number here is 800-478-8255. That's 800-478-TALK. Within Anchorage, it's 550-8422, email is talk@alaskapublic.org, and I'm hoping we might get some recipes or other food ideas coming in that way. I want to throw this out to both my guests. It seems like a lot of people take berries in the fall and do jellies and jams and so forth, and in a lot of cases, there's a huge amount of sugar that's being added to take these wild berries, which tend to be relatively tart. Raspberries, I guess, are pretty sweet, but if you think about cranberries or what are those little black ones with all the seeds that are used? I can't think of
crowberries.
Yeah, crowberries. You need tons of sugar. How do you do something like that without just making it taste like sugar? I mean, how do you get the distinctive flavor out? Is there a trick to that, or a science, or is it just sort of how you do it and it comes out or it doesn't? I mean, Rob, do you want to take that one? Do you make any jellies and jams?
I don't. I know enough. We're working with a bottling line. I mean, I've learned a ton about how you have to prepare the food to make it shelf stable. Mm-hmm. So I know enough not to comment on that because I think you can really hurt yourself if you don't, you know, if you don't can properly. I know the Fairbanks Cooperative Extension has got some amazing literature on canning. It's something I'm interested in, and I agree with that. I heard somewhere somebody's making jelly, and they're like, yeah, 1-to-1, like a cup of sugar to a cup of berries. Like, what do you have left with your, what are you canning really, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, I don't disagree with that notion, but I don't have enough knowledge to...
Do you want to weigh in on that, Jack, or I'll give you another question?
Well, just for a funny aside, my daughter harvested a bunch of crowberries this summer, and we infused vodka with it.
Ooh.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that sounds good. Anything with throw a little alcohol in it can spice it up. So the thing, not totally Alaskan, but pretty distinctively Alaskan, is smoked salmon. And there's a lot of different ways to do smoked salmon. I mean, if you do it in your electric Little Chief, then it's pretty much dried and almost baked. But a lot of native people, at least in South Central, will do it much lighter smoke, and then they'll can it. And it's got a much more delicate flavor and softer. And then I guess there's a cold smoke method that's more closer to lox. Jack, do you do any of that stuff?
We do a gravlox. With a lot of our salmon, we put up a bunch of the Copper River Reds, and then we move into silvers, and those are salt cured, which is another preservation technique without smoking, and it's very easy to do at home with fish that you have, and it's just a 3-day process. We do different ones and different herbs, but the classic is with dill. And that reflects back to some Scandinavian culture that you would find up here. And then the fish is covered with the dill, covered with salt and sugar, and then the two fillets are weighted together. And they produce a brine, and then you get the texture of like smoked lox without smoking it.
Hmm. So the brine itself is just doing the preservation of the food, and you're probably still refrigerating, and it didn't last forever. You got to use it.
And it freezes really nice. If we put it up from our salmon catch this year and then put it in food saver bags and put it into like 1-pound little chunks, and then bagels and gravlax in the morning is a great way to start your day.
Oh, definitely. Rob, do you have any tips on smoking? I know that people have all kinds of different things they put in the brine. You brine it, then you smoke it. But there's a lot of different ways to smoke too. Is there a distinctively Alaskan way to do that, or do you have any thoughts on that?
That's kind of like asking about your grandmother's Italian pasta recipe, right?
Right.
I mean, everybody's got a different thing. Even in so, I grew up in Southeast when I was younger, and that's kind of most of the salmon that I'll have. So it's cold smoked and then pressure packed.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, I got a chance to do some culinary webisodes. So we did 16 webisodes around the state. And in doing that, it was kind of amazing to have things like seal oil. And you have seal oil in Sitka, or seal oil, from like black meat seal oil, or canned with tundra herbs. And the same thing with salmon. I mean, it's, you know, I've seen it half smoked and dried, and I've seen it where they just kind of air dry it and then pressure cook it. So, and definitely, you know, in the restaurant world, grab lox and preserving. So, I think it's all fantastic, and there's so many different methods.
Here's a question coming in from a listener asking, non-stick pans, are they safe to use? Is there any concern that either of you guys have about chemicals and that sort of thing from using non-stick pans?
I think as long as the surface has been marred up and exposed, I think they're fine to use. I tend to use more like steel pans that can be seasoned instead.
Mm-hmm. Does that give you that same quality of just using a rubber spatula and you don't have to have too much work washing? Or you've got somebody working in the back so you don't care about how bad the washing is?
Well, no, they shouldn't. In a pan like that, you shouldn't get a stick to it. And especially if you use like a heavy French steel pan, you get that high heat so you can get that beautiful sear to it. One of the things that's different in restaurant cooking is we're not afraid of heat.
Right. You're more heat, it gives you different quality on the texture of the food that we home cooking people might not be familiar with. But you can do it at home with a good stove.
You certainly can. And it's just a matter of not being afraid to get your pan real hot and the food real hot. And, you know, like a lot of dishes, like we cooked some very nice simple halibut at home the other night. And I seared it in the pan and then added lemon juice and white wine and herbs and finished it in a 400-degree oven after it was flipped. So you have the two techniques. You have the sear on one side, and then you have a little baking technique to steam the fish and finish it.
Hmm. Sometimes if a thicker piece of halibut takes quite a long time, so you can't really do it. It's hard to grill or do in a pan because getting it cooked is difficult.
I try to cut my fillets no more than an inch thick and cut them on a bias, because you're absolutely right. And if they're too thick, by the time you get the interior cooked, you've overcooked the outside.
Right, which isn't so much of a problem with salmon, although as long as you're, some people do cut it. I mean, if it's a fillet, it's easy to cook through. If it's cut in the steak format, it's much harder to do, I think. Yes?
Yes, I'm not a big fan of steak formats. I prefer fillets.
Mm-hmm. So, Rob, do you have something else for us to share there?
Well, a couple of different things. One is, I was talking about this earlier, but this is Alaska Pure. It's an alder-smoked sea salt. And they actually have a few different varieties. This is a husband and wife, and they, you know, they've kind of got a little story here. I think this is a great example to me of, like, while it's kind of funny to talk about producing salt as a technology, but it's ancient. but it's, you know, this husband and wife, they basically, they're actually pretty quiet about how they do it, because it's seawater and all their smoked salt, but. The one thing I wanted to bring up with this and the idea of Alaska looking for that food culture is this was actually something that was produced and years before. I bought this at Sagaya the other day, and years before that, they were actually selling to, I'd mentioned, like, Eric Repair with Le Bernardin, and then Thomas Keller at the French Laundry and Per Se. And if Alaska is looking for that food culture and looking for that identity to grow, I think that this is a great opportunity, in the sense of, like, we don't have the infrastructure. We're not in Seattle, where we're next to I-5 and international waters. We're up here, we're removed away. So if we're producing something, we should be looking at top shelf ingredients. And I think this is an example of what Alaska's food culture could be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously seafood, but I mean, there's obviously, you know, I think we're hitting the mark short and not looking at all the resources.
Yeah. Boy, this salt, I wouldn't normally think of just tasting salt, but this is really delicious. It kind of like smoked salmon without the salmon. Jack, what's your reaction to it?
Oh, I think it's delicious, and I would use it as a finishing salt.
Exactly. Yeah, you wouldn't. Yeah, exactly.
Sprinkle it on top of something as a sort
of like fleur de sel or mm-hmm. one of those, you know, and enjoy the crunch of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So for most of Alaska, I mean, Anchorage, we have gourmet markets, but in most of Alaska, that doesn't exist. Is there a way people can access some of these products by mail order or something?
Well, I know the sea salt is available online, and that's through their company. I have a mustard here, a spruce tip mustard. That's another example of technology, in my opinion. Mustards are obviously not indigenous to Alaska, but the company Moustard, they integrate a local brewery with their beers. This is spruce tip. They use birch syrup, cranberries. So they do a lot of different types of mustards. They're available online and around the state. And then the bladder rack, that's something, the woman that procures this, I think that's pretty much, you have to go be in Sitka at the farmer's market
right.
to pick her stuff up.
Right. Well, there's opportunities for people to do more of that, but I guess you got to be careful to expand slowly and be careful not to overextend when you have that kind of business.
Alaska's been known to kind of grow industry quickly and then, build something. That's the other part of that. I think going back to, like, game meats or is policy, you know, mm-hmm. and processing plants, whatever. I mean, Alaska is not built like the rest of the lower 48. So we need to actually kind of adapt our USDA policies, in my opinion, to Alaska, and not make them more lenient, but just make them fit for the model. You know,
yeah.
You have USDA inspectors that get, snowed in Kodiak waiting or around the state or come up once a month. It's just, there's a lot of different pieces there mm-hmm. that I think need to be addressed.
Yeah. Well, we've got a bunch of questions coming in. I want to take just one before we go to the break. Bobby's asking, I think black cod, aka sable fish, is the best darn fish in the ocean. However, it seems to be underrepresented in restaurants. Could your guest respond to this? Why? And then she provides a recipe, a link to a recipe, which when I get home today, I'll see how many of these recipes I can get up on the website. Do you do sable fish?
We do use sable fish in the restaurant, and I agree with her. It's one of the finest fish that come out of the ocean. The amount of oil in it is just luscious. And it's largely a bycatch fish, so you don't see a lot of it, and a lot of it goes to Japan, so it's not easy to come by.
So what would you? How would you use it? I mean, is it you bake it? You pan fry it?
You can sear it. It's really rough to do on the grill because of the amount of fat that's in it. It'll flame up on you, and it's so tender that it'll start to fall apart.
Yeah.
But we do one with a miso marinade that we found to have great success with. People really like.
And I said we'd go to the break, but when you're grilling fish, I mean, that's always the challenge, is keeping it from falling apart. And there's all kinds of like cages you can put it in and stuff like that. It seems like if you've got I would love to hear your tips. It seems to me if you've got a good piece of salmon, you can put a fillet on a grill and then put a top on the grill and maybe not flip it and just grill it that way. Does that make sense to you, or how do you keep it from falling apart?
I like to leave the salmon for the grill skin on and start it with the flesh side down and get a sear on it, then flip it over and let it cook through the skin. And I'm actually a fan of that really crispy salmon skin. I find that particularly delicious.
Yeah, so you just make sure the grill is well oiled before you put the first side down so it doesn't stick when you flip it, basically.
Right. Yeah. And halibut is a hard fish on the grill. And we did it once this summer, and I made foil pouches for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then put a little bit of butter and lemon juice and herbs in it and put the pouch on the grill. And it was like a little papillote. It was like a little steam in there, and we found the fish came out really good that way.
Oh, great. Well, I'm really enjoying this topic. I hope you are, too. We're going to take a break and be back in just a moment when I'll give you the phone numbers to get on the air. It's Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
We're back with Talk of Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, sitting in for Steve Heimel, and in the studio, Rob Kanin, who is a sort of all-around local foods guru, you might say, has the fresh49.com blog, and Jack Ammon, who has the Marx Brothers restaurant and the Muse restaurant in Anchorage, and lots of calls and comments coming in about food, about cooking in Alaska, and we're going to get to as many as we can. I also want to give you our number in case you have anything you want to share or ask about. From outside Anchorage, it's 800-478-8255. That's toll-free, 800-478-TALK. Within Anchorage, it's 550-8422. And our email address is talk@alaskapublic.org. Here's a quick one. Jack, you mentioned cooking reindeer. Do you have any tips or what a good way to do reindeer?
Well, of course, the most important thing, depending on the cut, if you're using a shoulder or a piece like that, that's a braising cut. So you would want to cook in a liquid, cook it nice and slow, and tenderize it. If you're doing a backstrap or a tenderloin, sear it hot and keep it rare. And a little bit of marinade, because there's so little fat on the game meat. So olive oil, fresh thyme I like, crushed juniper berry I like.
All right, excellent. And here's one for you, Rob. This email, it's from Susan Summer. I maintain a website called Eat Local Alaska that consolidates information on eating Alaska-grown, produced, hunted, fished, and foraged foods. That sounds like a great one for us to link to, so I'll try to get that done after the show. I know some of the schools are using a few local foods. Are there any other institutions that are, such as hospitals, convention centers, et cetera? And I guess that's a key to getting these products into the market and able to actually work, right, is when big buyers start using them.
When you see the success, like when you walk into, you know, Costco and see reindeer sausage, for example, or even, I mean, I know, again, it's not indigenous, but like Taco Loco is a local company producing something. I think it's that kind of idea, just kind of accessibility. You know, that's, again, going back to the mantra for me, was awareness and accessibility of Alaska's food supply. You know, in the last restaurant job I had, I was breaking down elk. I was breaking down local hogs. As a chef that cared about that, I didn't even know those were available to me in the state, you know? So it's really just the food circle here, in my opinion, is a little broken. And I think also, you know, I was seeking all that out, but I know there's a lot of chefs. I mean, they're pretty busy people. I mean, Jack owns two restaurants, and he's probably doesn't have a lot of time to do a ton of research to find out, or wait for that one day a month window when that hog is available from the valley or whatever it is. So, you know, it's bridging all those gaps and finding that information and bringing it in.
So some of these websites could be a big help. I mean, that seems like a good technology thing. It's when you've got very small markets, you can use the web to identify and connect buyers and sellers.
There's a great, my buddy Dave Thorne, he's got Alaska Root Sellers, and he actually drives out to the valley, picks up, and kind of does consolidating, basically. So he's a chef, call him the rock and roll chef. He travels around the country with different you know, rock stars and cooks for him. But then in the summer, he's usually up here doing caterings, and then he also does that during the summer.
Got a call now from Petersburg. Anne has a question. Anne?
Oh, hi. I just had a comment, actually, and I know this is a big topic to talk about, so I'll be brief, but I just wanted to go back to salt for a minute. A few years ago, we did an experiment with salt, and we just would get went out in the skiff and got a bucket full of salt from about five different locations around town here, because we're on an island. And it was fun. We just boiled it down, and then we put it on a tray and dried it in the oven for the last part of it. And it was what was interesting about it to me was the different qualities of the different salts from the different places that were maybe just 4 miles apart.
A little bit of flavor difference, because there's a lot of other stuff in the ocean. You're probably eating a lot of plankton and a lot of good, probably healthy stuff that's out there that would give you a little bit different flavor.
Well, some was gray and had a different, and then others, the one from LeConte was the best, from the mouth of LeConte. That was a wonderful, pure white, beautiful texture, yummy salt. So anyway.
Neat. Thanks for the call. Now I'd like to go to another caller who it looks like has something to say about salt. Doug is calling from Talkeetna. Doug?
Oh, yeah. How you doing?
Great.
Hey, great show. I was going to call in earlier to mention the Alder Smoke sea salt product, and then you guys started talking about it. But I just wanted to say, and I think it's the folks that you had mentioned there, it's the place out of Willow, they make it. Can I mention their name?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. I think their company is called Susitna Sugar and Spice, or at least one of the manufacturers of Alder Smoke Willow. And I got turned on to it here a couple years ago, and it has revolutionized a couple of my favorite recipes. It's a wonderful product. I've sent it to people for gifts, you know, from out of state. They also make other sort of spices. But the one, it's not an Alaskan dish, but the one recipe that it has completely revolutionized are my ultimate buffalo wings.
All right.
Nice.
So unless you, you know, had enough spruce hen to make, you know, buffalo wings with, you have to use, you know, chicken. But anyways, it's a great product. I just made some salmon last night that I, you know, braised on the stove, and then made a nice glaze for, topped it off in the oven, and then added a little dash of that salt on top, and it just really is a wonderful addition to almost anything.
That's great. Thanks, Doug. And I've found that sometimes one seasoning will make a huge difference and change your whole, you know, I'm just a family cook, but I was making chicken last night in the pan, and I realized that I'd thrown cumin in instead of paprika, which was like not what I had planned, but then I thought, well, that might be interesting, and people kind of liked it. So sometimes that's just changing one little thing is make a dramatically different dish. All right, so we have a call from Sitka. Evening, did you have a call, a comment or question?
Hi, I grew up in Southeast, and I ate fish and deer and everything from the land, and every once in a while I look at our what we got on the table, on the menu, and I'll think, what's on the plate that I can make myself some other way instead of buying it at the store? And kind of got it down to I can't do things with milk products and grains, so I keep buying those, but I grow as much as I can of other things. But the thing I started making was ham out of deer hindquarters in a wet cure and brine, and then I would smoke them either on alder or maple or applewood, and then we package that up for sandwich meat over the year.
Wow, that's a challenge. That sounds like you're really committed to doing this.
Yeah, I'm pretty committed. It takes days. It's really simple, but it takes days.
Yeah, right. I remember visiting my great uncle who had a dairy farm in Virginia, and he went into his barn and he had all these, in the dark, there were all these Virginia hams hanging up with mold growing all over them, aging. Would you guys ever do that kind of aged meat? Is that something that is you think of as an Alaskan food at all? I guess
I bring home a deer, I'll skin it out and quarter it and hang it and keep it cool for a week or, if I can, or 10 days. And it all depends on the quality of the job that person does taking care of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've aged it that way, but I've never hung things long enough to get moldy. And it's really difficult to find people that have that knowledge around here that are willing to share it with other people.
Let me turn to our two chefs about aging of, domestic meat, but then also aging of wild meat. Is that an important thing, and how does that affect the flavor of meat? Jack?
The aging process helps break down, it works with the proteins and breaks down and can tenderize the meat. It also concentrates the flavors. So finding a dry-aged meat will definitely give it a more intense flavor. I'm not so sure how well aging it too long with gay meats would work because of the lack of fat content in there.
Yeah. Rob?
I agree. There's a restaurant in town, Crush, that actually, when you walk in the front door, they've got a cooler where they've got a couple of hindquarters of prosciutto aging, and then they'll have steak, New York's, et cetera, aging as well. And usually 4 or 5 days on that dry aging, is you can just taste the difference on there, the concentration of flavors. I remember as a kid, I'd go in, I was born in Petersburg, and my uncle flew a plane, and he had a double-car garage, and in Petersburg, you don't really need a vehicle, but I remember in the fall time walking in there, and you'd have 16 deer all aging. I agree. I think because they're so lean, I couldn't imagine aging them for, a year or whatever.
Right.
I don't know if that would be a good idea.
Here's a great email from Lisa. Don't know where she's coming from. It's from Gmail. My husband and I were sitting down. Oh, I'm sorry. They're on Kodiak. My husband and I were sitting down to a meal of sourdough waffles when your program came on. We're listening from a small community of 6 people on the west side of Kodiak Island. Hot cakes, waffles, breads, and even cakes and cookies made from sourdough starters passed from traveler to traveler, families, and communities is very much a part of the Alaska's food tradition. I've actually traced the genealogy of my heirloom starter. For me, knowing the stories of the other people who have used it over the decades makes it interesting and even more fun to eat. One of my favorite recipes is to mix smoked salmon into the batter. After you take them out of the waffle iron, sprinkle sharp cheddar cheese on the top and broil them just long enough to melt the cheese. Do you guys do anything with sourdough? And I mean, that's Alaskan because, I mean, it's not native Alaskan, but sort of came up with the gold rush. Anybody want to chime in?
When my daughter was a kid, we would always do sourdough pancakes on Sunday morning, and the exercise of re-fermenting the starter and keeping it going. And we had our starter came from the Gottstein family, and it was traced back to Jake Gottstein, who was the first of them that came up here. So it is a fun tradition to do that. It's a living product that goes back farther and farther. It is a lot of fun to
use. And
it's
very distinctive flavor for bread and pancakes, and it's different. I guess it's somewhat an acquired taste, but I really like it.
I agree. I've had, in the past growing up, same thing, pancakes with the family. Actually, when I was in Culinary Institute of America, one of the baking instructors had his name was Charlie, sourdough starter. It was supposed to be 100 and some odd years old from Alaska. So whether or not that was true, I don't know. But I think that, again, kind of with the idea of like Alaska's food culture, it isn't just indigenous. There's a lot of different pieces of the puzzle that have come up here, including, you know, going to Barrow and seeing like Pacific Islander foods when you're at the AC store. I mean, there's a lot of different cultures up here, and I think embracing all of that is sort of the next step. So,
yeah. Boy, this is a great topic. I'm having a good time. It's I'm here with Rob Kinnean and Jack Ammon, both chefs from Anchorage, and lots of calls coming in. We're going to go to some more of those calls in just a moment after we take a break. And my name is Charles Woolforth. I'm sitting in today for Steve Heimel. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. And by the Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
We're back on Talk of Alaska, and we're just going to keep going through the calls and talking about food. It's really fun, a fun topic. Danielle's calling from Soldotna. Danielle?
Hi. My question is about creme brulee, and I know you guys have been talking about different foods in Alaska, and I'm from Soldotna, but I recently was traveling over in Puerto Rico and was talking to the chef over there about different things I can infuse into my creme brulee. And I was really excited when you told me about lavender, and I want to do that. But what I wanted to know from you guys is what you suggest Alaskan-wise. I don't even know where to start, if you suggest like a fireweed or what. But I'd like to know if you have any recommendations for infusing into a creme brulee from something that's local.
Who wants to take that one first?
Rob will take it.
Yeah.
You know, I had in my past life, I had a place, and we had a birch syrup creme brulee on the menu, and we tried taking it off a couple times. It was pretty much chaos. So I think birch syrup is fantastic, I know Mark's Brothers uses that as well in a couple of desserts.
We do, yeah.
So you know, and it's expensive, but if you know, a little goes a long way as well. So I think that's fantastic. I think fireweed would be interesting. If you know, and I know there's, again, Simple Pleasures makes a product like a syrup. So something like that might be good.
All right. Good one, Danielle. Does that give you something to work from?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for calling. Now we're going to go to Jim from Sitka, who has been waiting a long time. Jim?
Good morning, Charles. Thanks for the show today. I'm enjoying it.
Great.
And I'd like to give a shout out to Rob for the mention of my wife and my company. I'll leave that at that. But a couple things. The call earlier about the venison ham.
Mm-hmm.
It was several years back, I did a venison hind leg prosciutto, and I salted it with some herbs and salted it for a couple weeks, and then larded the entire ham, the back leg of the venison, and hung it for months, and was really excited for Mother's Day when I was going to take it down, shave the first piece off, and make a Mother's Day brunch with it. And the night before that, a dog came up on the porch and ate the entire thing.
Oh, no.
So I can't tell you whether venison prosciutto, the long aging, works or not, but I'll tell you that the bone smelled delicious.
Yeah, so that's the danger of putting that much work into one thing, right? You know, you've got a lot on the line. Good
exactly.
Story. Thanks,
Jim. What I was really calling was to mention a chef out of Washington State by the name of Blaine Wetzel. He has a restaurant called the Willows Inn that's being highly acclaimed as one of the best restaurants in the nation these days. And we were lucky enough to go eat there a few weeks ago, and he's on Lummi Island, and the entire menu comes from that little tiny island other than just a handful of ingredients. And he's been to Sitka, I've taken him out fishing, we were looking at the herring spawn last spring, and he truly believes that Alaska is poised to be the place where the next best restaurant of the world could be, just because of the availability of wild ingredients, if people become knowledgeable about foraging and really take advantage of what we have in our backyards.
Mm-hmm. You're right. And I think herring spawn is one of the most delicious things in the world. I mean, to me, it's very equal to caviar. If you were lucky enough to be there when the herring spawn is taking place and eat some of that popweed with it's just encrusted with the little eggs, they burst on your teeth. It's just delicious.
I absolutely love it, too. So, you know, we started out a business just by kind of exploring the Alaska foods, and I guess I would just want to encourage others to do it because there's such a wealth of opportunity we have. And not only is food and farm-to-table becoming such a way of life for people, but Alaska is getting the media attention also, especially what I believe it's tomorrow is the next episode of Top Chef Seattle on TV, and it finishes up in Juneau with the finale in Juneau. So we're poised to get a lot of national attention for business startups if people are creative and hardworking to find these items to try and put out there.
Yeah, the attention Alaska is getting is amazing. Thanks, Jim. We have so many callers. I'm going to keep moving here. Tony has emailed in, say one of her personal favorite Alaskan dishes is a salmon Wellington at Marx Brothers. And I don't know if you want to talk about that recipe in particular, Jack, but I was wondering how you handle the fact that you've been around for so long, you're an institution, everybody's got their favorite items they want to see on the menu, and yet you're always experimenting and changing and trying to do new things as well. I mean, is there a sort of a desire on your customers to keep everything always the same, or do you try to innovate all the time?
It's a dual-edged sword, because when you take something off that people like, then they want to have it back. But by the same token, you want to keep new foods coming, and tastes change, and food evolves, and our culinary tradition evolves. And we have a new young chef at Marx Brothers. And each of the chefs that we've had, we've been there 33 years, brings their own flair to it. So we keep our classics on the menu. In the summer, we always have the macadamia halibut till the halibut goes out of season. And certain dishes like that. But at the same token, we like to experiment with different treatments of the same food. So you got to do both.
Mm-hmm. And you don't want to be too trendy, I suppose. I mean, there's also this thing that gets a little tiresome. At least for me, I'm not a total foodie who's always like reading food magazines. And there's some sort of a trendiness that gets a little bit irritating to me, at least in some restaurants. I don't know if you guys, I'm not getting any nods, so I guess these guys don't feel that way. I'd like to go to Michelle, who is, Michelle is calling from Anchorage. Michelle?
Yes. Hello. Yeah. Good morning, Jack and Rob. Congratulations on trying to keep up our food, Alaskan food, to be known all over. As you know, I've been trying to do it for the last 44 years. And the thing which I really love with the young generations of chefs and you guys who's been, especially Jack, who's been for 33 years, as you say, it's each one of you, you came up with some new recipe, new concept. And this is really good for following through, adapting it, modifying it, and creating a new recipe. And that's one thing I really love. It took a long time for Alaska to come from mashed potato and fried shrimps to accept this type of concept, like when Jack started it. I mean, that was fantastic. So congratulations. Keep the good work. Keep churning out those recipes which can inspire. And the thing is, never, never underestimate. Could be whatever, a housewife, could be somebody from with hardly any knowledge, but there is always something to learn from one of those person, and that's what I found when I was teaching in the bush. Okay, guys, that's all what I've got to say. Keep the good job.
Great comment. Thank you. You know, and we're talking about Alaskan food and these great chefs who produce this wonderful food. But then there's also something very Alaskan about a pilot cracker with sardines on it. So it's easy to make, too. Henry's calling from Sitka about sablefish. Henry?
Yeah. I just had a question about a comment that was made earlier about sablefish being mainly a bycatch species. And I just thought that was odd. I commercial fish for a living, and sablefish happens to be one that I fish for, and I just never heard that. I was hoping that they could elaborate on it.
Jack?
I just know from availability that we don't see that much sable fish come through. It's one that you really have to suss out. I know Favco here in Alaska is good about carrying sable fish, but it isn't an abundance. It's a small fishery, I think, compared to, well, Colin might disagree, but compared to halibut or salmon, it is a more limited fishery, so we see less of it.
Well, I know a lot of it is immediately shipped over to Japan and other countries, and United States is a very small market still for it, though it is growing. But I was just kind of curious if you knew if there was a place that actually catches more of it as a bycatch than the actual fishery. And I would agree that there is other fisheries that are much bigger than table fish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we've got chefs in the room rather than fisheries experts. So I don't know if we can answer that one. But it raises a question that's of interest to me, which is that we all cook our own fish that we catch. And obviously we catch a wide variety of fish. But if you walk into the grocery store in Anchorage or most other places in Alaska, you're going to find maybe there's fresh salmon for $10 a pound. And then there's going to be maybe Atlantic salmon or frozen salmon. There might be some halibut. There might be some cod. And then you're going to see stuff like swordfish and stuff that comes from other places. But the wide variety of our seafood is not available to most sort of everyday cooks unless they're catching it themselves. And when you run a top restaurant, obviously you have more choices. But is there any way, maybe you know, Rob, is there any way people can find some more exotic ingredients for home cooking? Or is it more of a hobbyist sort of thing?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, again, kind of going back to the Sitka Seafood Festival, you know, for the first couple of years I was the guest chef and then the chef liaison. And because it's a fundraising effort, you know, what we do is it's kind of hard to keep looking for sponsorships and saying salmon, king crab, halibut, right? Because you're talking about a lot of money. So what we've actually been trying to focus on is bycatch or other items. I know I was talking to Asmi about the idea of herring. Like once they get out into the Bering Sea, they actually get pretty big. And using other items, I remember a long time ago, I think the Marx Brothers was actually selling Arctic char.
Yeah, that was a great fish to get, and it was a small fishery, and it came from up in Kotzebue, and it was such a thrill to serve a fish that was caught north of the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, I think it's, again, going back to education, you know, I tried at a restaurant I was a chef at, I put Alaskan skate on the menu, and it went over like a hot rock. But I know that, you know, for example, going back to sable fish, I know there's also just, I think the demand is so quick, it goes right overseas. Yeah. And I was kind of agreeing with Jack. I thought it was actually just a short bycatch season, but I think that's actually general cod.
And I have one more caller. I don't know if we'll have time for it, but Paul, you had something quick about red currants?
Yes. You never have to use sugar. You parboil it in a quart mason jar. You pick all your red currants, mash them, put them through a strainer so you get all the seeds out, a little bit of water maybe to rinse it in, and then you heat it up just enough, and then you can put your lid on it and can it, and it's an excellent thick syrup for anything. You don't have to add sugar.
Great.
You add water, and then that thins out the sourness. You could say it takes away the sourness. And you have tons of vitamins. You can
add for a little. Thanks for the tip, Paul. We're out of time, and I just wanted to make sure we got you in. What a great topic. Lots of good calls. I want to thank my guest, Rob Kanin, fresh49.com blog. You can find a lot of more of his ideas. Jack Ammon has the Marx Brothers restaurant and the Muse restaurant here in Anchorage. Dave Waldron was our engineer. Pat Yak is our director of news and public affairs and was managing the
phone. Possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Condor Airlines with connecting flights from Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Kodiak, Nome, and Prudhoe Bay to Anchorage on Alaska Airlines, and continuing nonstop service to Frankfurt. Details at condor.com.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.